Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here, and we're trying something new, packaging three of our favorite segments from the week for you to listen to on the weekend in case you missed them. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Have a great weekend. WNYC with our family meeting on sleep today. And now a deeper dive on what to do about your insomnia. Our next guest is Shelby Harris, the director of the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Program at Montefiore Medical Center and an advisor to WNYC's Clock Your Sleep Project. Dr. Harris, welcome to the Brian Lehrer Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So listeners, if you struggled with insomnia or have had trouble staying asleep through the night in the past but figured out what helps you sleep, give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. And if you want the benefit of Dr. Harris's expertise, call in with your questions. Your questions welcome here, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. So Dr. Harris, you specialize, as I said, in cognitive behavioral therapy to help people sleep. What is that exactly and how does it work?
Okay. So CBT, or cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia, we call it CBTI, is really considered in the sleep field the gold standard treatment for insomnia right now. Problem is, there aren't a lot of people who are specially trained in it. So when we think about CBTI, it's really the cognitive part and the behavioral part. So a lot of people who have insomnia, what happens over time is that they start to change behaviors that they normally would do before they ever had sleep problems. So people might start going to bed earlier or sleep in the morning or sleep in on the weekends, napping, trying to catch sleep whenever they can. They also start to lay in bed longer amounts of time. They might watch TV in bed or start to try and force sleep to happen, have more caffeine. So we really try to change the behaviors that they're doing that are getting in the way of their sleep, as well as worries about sleep. So people start to worry, I won't be able to function tomorrow, and they get very anxious at night. So it's a very short-term treatment for most people, 4 to 12 sessions of changing the behaviors and the thoughts about sleep. And it's just as effective as medications in the short term.
Give me an example of how you try to eliminate people's worry about not being able to sleep, because it's such a self-reinforcing cycle. You don't get enough sleep. You don't get enough sleep again. You think it's a chronic problem for you. So then you worry about not being able to get enough sleep. And that in itself keeps you up. But it's a legitimate worry. So how do you just tell yourself, try not to try?
Right. So what we notice is when people, I think the fact that we're doing all this sleep diary data and tracking your sleep is really helpful. What we notice for many people is that if you go one night of really bad sleep or even no sleep for some people, which is pretty unusual, usually by the second night and usually even more so by the third night, you tend to get more sleep. So I usually have patients repeat a mantra to themselves that if I don't sleep tonight, I'll sleep better tomorrow, and if not, then by the third. And sometimes knowing that you can't control the sleep and kind of giving it up to your body and your body will sleep with the behavioral changes you make can kind of let the pressure go a little bit and the worry.
So that's the cognitive part.
Exactly.
Understanding that.
Understanding that you can't always make yourself go to sleep even though you want to.
And then what's the behavioral part?
So the behavioral part that I see most often is patients with insomnia, they tend to spend too much time in bed awake. So they're laying there 8 hours in bed, but they're only sleeping 4 or 5 hours a night. So what we actually do is we limit them, within reason, to a certain amount of hours that they're sleeping at night. We usually don't do less than 4 or 5 hours, but you're laying in bed 8 hours. You're 3 hours of the night, you're laying there tossing and turning. So I'd rather people go to bed later but get up at the same time every day. And when they start falling asleep faster and staying asleep more, then we slowly increase the time in bed that they're allowed. And that works very well for a number of insomnia patients.
And so if you're going to let yourself off the hook from worrying about sleep, mm-hmm. it means you just have to kind of have a more relaxed attitude about how crappy you feel during the day after you haven't gotten enough sleep?
That's a really good point. You know, you have to be realistic about it. So patients, I often think that at 3, 4 in the morning, I know for myself, the rational side of our brain is not always taking over. So we wake up and we often think to ourselves, how am I going to get through tomorrow? I'm not going to be able to function. I won't be able to do anything. But if you really work with someone or you think about it yourself, you think realistically. So maybe you won't be at 100% functioning level, but maybe 70% of you, maybe you'll get through work. You might not do as great as normal, but the catastrophizing part probably isn't going to be there. So if you can get through that part, it will help you function the next day.
Glenn in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC, Brian Lehrer Show Family Meeting on Sleep. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Brian. Big fan, been listening for years.
Thank you.
I am a chronic insomniac, and one of the tricks that I've used that sometimes works to help me get to sleep is to count back from 100 or even 200 if it's not working by 7.
I think that's a great technique that you use. There's something that we like to think of as cognitive distraction. I think that's a really good technique of cognitive distraction. And sometimes patients find that just counting by numbers, like 99, 98, is not distracting enough, that actually have some patients count backwards by 3s or by 7s, and they find that that can help even more. But if you have a constant thought loop in your head before you go to bed at night, doing something like the numbers or visual imagery can actually be really helpful to get in the way of the thoughts.
So this is the most stereotypical, classic sleep aid that you could think of. This is like counting sheep.
Exactly. And there is a lot of benefit to counting sheep. Just some people find it's very silly and they do something else.
So something repetitive like that to kind of lull yourself to sleep. Does the rhythm kind of matter?
You know, I think the rhythm can be beneficial because it can, like you said, lull yourself to sleep. But what I like is something that's focused that has movement to it. So counting sheep, you're counting and you're picturing them going over, you know, the fence. Counting backwards, there's movement to it. So you're having some sort of focused imagery or thought process.
Joan in Manhasset. You're on WNYC. Hi, Joan.
I go to sleep very quickly, sleep very deeply. I read before I go to bed. I don't have television in the room. I'm exercising, all the good things I do, you know.
You're so much better than everybody. No, I'm kidding.
But I sleep for 2 hours, almost like a clock, and I'm awake, and then I don't go back to sleep. I guess my anxiety is beginning to extend because I hear so much about I'm supposed to have 7 or 8 hours sleep, and I'm wondering about zones, or you talk about blocks. It almost feels like macular degeneration where the center goes, and I sleep so well at the beginning, and then maybe at 4, 5, I go back to sleep for a little bit, but I get up at 6, so, you know, I'm up then. Now, sometimes I know that I'm worrying, but sometimes I'm not, and yet the pattern remains. And yet I function during the day. I seem to be okay, and I keep saying to myself, maybe I'm not okay because everything says I should be sleeping longer. And those 2 hours I know are very deep. I don't think I hear anything during those 2 hours. Could it be that that is enough sleep for me?
Well, I think that's a really interesting point that you bring up with the 7, 8 hours. I find that with patients with insomnia, they often focus on that. I need to get the 7 hours because so-and-so said so. What we know is that the majority of people need between 6 and 9 hours of sleep a night. So that's the majority of people to feel well-rested and refreshed during the next day. But there are people who are outliers who need less and some people who actually need a lot more than 8 or 9 hours a night. 2 hours is more on the extreme range, but you said also that you go back to sleep later on for a little while at 4, 5, 6 in the morning. So what might be something that you could think about also is how do you feel the next day? You said you're feeling okay during the next day, but if you're noticing that maybe you're having some memory issues or you're feeling fatigued at certain points, that's something to consider. And also, I don't know your exact sleep schedule history or anything, but maybe going to bed a little bit later, sometimes we find for some people going to bed later helps to push the awakening later, and then you might sleep a little later in the night.
Joan, thank you. Good luck. Are there different cognitive behavioral techniques for getting back to sleep than for originally getting to sleep?
I think that the things that work the best, one thing that's simple that many people do but does get in the way is looking at the clock. So everyone gets up in the middle of the night, they look at what the clock time is, and then they start doing the math. Oh, I've taken 4 hours to fall asleep, and now I finally fell asleep. Math does not help me get sleepy. I don't think it helps a lot of people get sleepy. So stop looking at the clock. And then what you were saying about what we were saying earlier about going to bed later, sometimes going to bed later can help push the awakening later, but you've got to keep the wake time the same 7 days a week. That's key.
Here's a related tip, I think, from a commenter on our website. Mm-hmm. Maria from Brooklyn writes that her brother told her that their dad told him, don't worry about falling asleep, just lying still and resting your body is good enough. And she says, when my mom scoffed at this and said my dad had given useless advice, my brother said, true or not, because he told me resting was good enough, I was able to stop worrying and sleep.
Ah, that's really interesting. I think it's like you were saying, the taking the worry out of it is what really helps a lot of people, even though we're constantly bombarded about you have to do this, you have to do this. Laying in bed, though, for long amounts of time and just resting is not – I mean, it feels better than just getting up and doing things, but laying in bed for prolonged amounts of time teaches your body that the bed is a place to lay awake and to think. So we actually prefer patients to get out of bed.
Really? That surprises me.
It's, you know, I think of a lot of cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia as being the anti-common sense treatment because we say, oh, we need to catch sleep when we can. But really, getting out of bed and going sitting somewhere else in dimly lit room and doing something to pass the time that's mildly pleasurable, like reading a magazine or listening to music or doing relaxation stretches, that is better than laying in bed because laying in bed just continues to teach yourself the bed's a place to worry and to lay awake.
And it's also counterintuitive, I think, to go to sleep later in order to get more sleep, the thing you said before, as opposed to if you're tired at 9:30,
right,
just go to sleep at 9:30. It's kind of weird for an insomniac to purposely keep themselves up for
right.
a couple of more hours.
It is, and especially with patients that I have who have trouble falling asleep at night, when I give them the idea of saying, well, maybe we're going to go to bed at midnight or 1 in the morning, and they look at me like I have three heads, I say, well, what's your concern? They say, well, how am I ever going to stay up until 12 or 1? I look at them, and I say, well, you're cured.
Problem solved, yep. Dion in Mount Vernon, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dion.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Thank you for calling.
I have two points that I'd like to make. One, the first thing, I think it is mainly cultural. And secondly, I'll tell you how I deal with my culture shock and how I force myself to sleep. I'm a Jamaican. When I used to live in Jamaica, I had no problem sleeping because, one, the conditions were conducive to sleep when you want to sleep, and that is usually at night. Now that I've relocated to the United States, and in particular New York, what I notice is that my preoccupation with just about everything has soared significantly. I'm overwhelmed with a whole lot of things that I call unnecessary. And in my home situation, there is so much inundation of information passing right, left, and center. There's a radio and a television on in every single room. And what that does is that I get so overwhelmed with a whole lot of information that I'm processing that by the time I go to sleep, I think I am processing all of these things, thinking about all my day, and I get all excited again lying in bed, so I can't sleep. But in Jamaica, that wasn't the case. When it is bedtime, I did not have a television in my room. When it was bedtime, it was bedtime. When it was sleep time, it was sleep time. And I would usually go to bed by 10:30, the latest. Here, I'm going to bed at 2.
So, Dion,
so what do I do?
Dion has stepped into our wired, technologically overexposed world in the New York area, it sounds like.
Very much so.
Yes, and there are lots of sirens. Everywhere you go, there are sirens. There's horn tooting. There are so many, many sounds. That's too many sounds, a cacophony of sounds everywhere that you go. So you're always constantly alert.
Dion, hang on a second because my producer wants to ask you a question off the air. But first, let's give Dion some advice. And that culture shock, I wonder how many immigrants to New York, whether they're from other countries or whether they're from central Iowa somewhere, have the same experience.
This is something my main practice is at Montefiore Medical Center, and this is something I hear all the time. When I lived so-and-so other place, this was never a problem until I came to New York City. I think the big thing we have to think about, which Deanna just mentioned, is she doesn't really get to process her day until right before it's time to go to bed. And Sleep is not an on-off switch, although we'd like it to be because there's not enough time in the day. You really need to allow for a good half hour, ideally an hour, to let your brain decompress, and ideally without screens, to really let your brain know that the end of the day is coming near. And at the beginning of that hour, that's when you want to maybe – some patients actually benefit from journaling. Just think about your day and process it at that point, because if you try to process it right before bed, there's no way your brain's going to shut off.
But let me play devil's advocate here. If I'm journaling before going to sleep, then I might be thinking about all the issues in my day, which might keep me up.
Right.
If I turn on the television and put on some mindless old sitcom rerun or something, maybe I'm going to fall asleep.
Right. I think the screen can be a tricky issue. If you're someone who has trouble falling asleep and you're very alert at night, the screen isn't always ideal. It is something that can then take your mind off of things. But if it's really not helping, there are things like actually you can buy blue blocker glasses, things like that you can wear so you can watch TV if it's a mindless episode to help.
Jim in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. You use some kind of media to go to sleep? Jim? Jim. All right, we'll try to get back to Jim. See, I tried to make such a perfect segue with what Jim had told our screener, but he wasn't there. I want to ask you about white noise.
Sure.
White noise, they say, has helped lots of babies stay asleep while the rest of the family is still awake and making noise. And a lot of people, grown-ups, swear the white noise machines help them fall asleep. There are sounds available. We're going to play some sounds.
Great.
Okay. From a particular white noise machine. It's the Conair SU1W sound therapy machine. This is not to recommend it or say that there are other ones that are worse or better. But it's the number one seller on Amazon, available for $19.99 with free shipping, they say. Did anyone out there – all right. So let's – we're going to play some different sounds from this machine right now. Okay, the first one is what they call bird song. Now I know why they call it bird song.
Calming.
Heartbeat. Babbling brook. That's too loud for me. I think it's going to come over the shore and flood my tent. The next one is waves. And finally, the one that the SU1W sound therapy machine just calls white noise. What makes this noise white?
Oh, gosh. I mean, what I like about this noise is there is no – it's just very constant. There is nothing else coming in. So when you're thinking about the other things we listen to, the wave, the heartbeat, the bird, there are little – it's not constant. There's little noises here and there, different
– there's a lot of bass here.
Yeah, exactly. I actually, in all honesty, I use a white noise machine to sleep at night, and
I love it.
It. I started using it about 6 months ago, and it drowns out any outside noise for me. And I wouldn't say I need it to go to sleep, but it's definitely something missing that I can hear outside noises even more when I don't have it on. I love it.
Is it the nature of the noise itself is conducive to sleep, or that it blocks out other noises that are more coming and going?
I think it's a mix. I think the constant noise itself is what can help lull some people to sleep. But I think the bigger thing, especially here in New York City, is there are a lot of noises outside. And if you have a white noise machine, it can help. Now, that being said, there was a controversial or a study that came out recently that looked at white noise with babies and said that some people are using these machines way too loud, that it's actually hurting the hearing on some young children. There's nothing like that for adults, though. So I usually will keep my white noise machine outside by the door. And it's pretty good at blocking noise if that is an issue for you.
It's our family meeting on sleep on The Brian Lehrer Show. Join our Clock Your Sleep project at wnyc.org/sleep. That'll be going on through the month of April. My guest, Dr. Shelby Harris, the director of the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Program at Montefiore Medical Center, and Amy in Harrington Park. You're on WNYC. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning. I discovered a way to get back to sleep when I was pregnant 19 years ago. When I would wake up to go to the bathroom, as all pregnant women do, I found that if I could just keep any image or memory from a dream that I was having, when I got back into bed, if I could, you know, like a color, an image, anything, I would go right back to sleep. And I find that continues to work for me.
I think that's a great technique to use, and that's something I use, something similar to a lot of with a lot of my patients, that it's that focused cognitive task that is not very exciting, but at least takes your mind off of anything else that can really help to bring sleep on.
Amy, thank you. Yes, pregnant women and middle-aged men all wake up to pee.
Oh, yes, very common. And women going through menopause, too. Huh. It's very common then.
Raj in Basking Ridge, you're on WNYC. Hey, Raj.
Hi, Brian. Great show. I'm a long-time listener.
Thank you.
Quick question about sleep. How does sex help sleep? And also, if I'm doing it, like some days if I don't, then I'm afraid that I shouldn't be using this as a way to get more sleep.
Well, are you saying that your experience is that if you have sex, then you sleep better?
Yes.
Is it best to do that for you just before going to sleep?
Yes.
I think there's a variety. I've seen both happen. I've seen a lot of patients who say that sex is a stress reliever for them, and they find that that actually helps them go to sleep. Other people, though, on the opposite, have the opposite reaction. They find it's too alerting. So then we have to recommend that you have sex earlier in the day, because if it's really going to be alerting, then you probably shouldn't be doing it before bedtime.
Note from the doctor, sex can be arousing.
There you
go. We figured that out. What's your approach to medication? Because I know you're a behavioral cognitive therapist, so obviously we've been focusing on that. But when do you tell your patients to start on it? Or do they all come to you after Ambien or some such thing and the natural melatonin and whatever other, you know, health food store stuff have already failed them?
Right. The ideal, really, and I like to go by the sleep medicine guidelines, is to really try to do CBTI if possible. And there's nothing else that's really going to get in the way of being able to do it.
CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy without drugs.
Yep. We try to do that first. It's ideal so you're not having to use medication. If you're not responding in 4 to 5 sessions, then we do go the medication route. That being said, I'm at a sleep center, and people don't come to a sleep center right off the bat. So the majority of people I see at the sleep center have gone to their primary care doctor, have tried everything under the sun, nothing works, so then they end up with me. I normally see people who are on meds, but they don't work as great as they'd like or they'd like to get off them. That's when they usually come to me.
How about alcohol? I know somebody who says alcohol is definitely a sleep aid.
Alcohol does make you sleepy. That's why a lot of people will use it. They'll have that glass of wine or whatever before bed. The problem with alcohol is it makes the quality of your sleep really poor. So people might have more awakenings at night, or they'll just not feel as refreshed in the morning. So it's actually a really terrible sleep aid to use throughout the night.
Why does it make the quality of your sleep poor?
It wears off. So it wears off. So your body then basically wakes up craving more alcohol. And we all know that that is not a good technique to get into to sleep.
Darlene in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Darlene.
Hi. Two things. One, and I don't think anybody has mentioned these, and yes, I stay awake. I wake up. But before I go to bed, if I can take a hot bath, and they're old news, not to wash, but literally just to soak in a hot bathtub, I find I'm falling asleep. And when I go to sleep, if I now wear the blindfold over the eyes, which, you know, I used to laugh about on I Love Lucy, I think she wore them, I find that when I wake up, I have to go to the bathroom, but once I go back to bed, if I don't see the light and somehow the blindfolds keep it darker, I am able to go back to sleep faster, to the point where if I don't have those, I sleep worse than if I did have them. So I just wanted to put those two suggestions out there. They're inexpensive, they're cheap, and they really do work for me.
Darlene, thank you. And you know you live in Brooklyn when you have to wear a blindfold to keep out the light at night.
Right. I think the interesting thing that she also brought up was the hot baths. So there was a number of studies done in Japan a while ago that actually looked at people who took hot 20-minute hot baths about an hour and a half to 2 hours before bedtime. And that has been shown to help induce sleep. It has to do with our body temperatures and circadian rhythms, but it can help. Right before bed for most people can actually make your mind calm, but it can be physically too alerting. But an hour and a half before bed is really very beneficial for people.
Deborah in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Deborah.
Oh, hey, hello. There is a third leg to this three-legged stool you all have not introduced yet. We've done the medical, the overt medical, you know, the sleep apnea and the obesity. Now we're doing the behavioral mm-hmm. and the cognitive.
Right.
But you've not gotten to the matter of more recent, of recent science paralleling this in the 90s of sleep clocks. Sleep clocks are a vital issue in resetting sleep that has not been factored in or presented now. And I know about this personally over a lifetime. That in when I was 12, I apparently had the disruption of a sleep clock that made it very difficult until the late 90s, we're talking from the 60s to the 90s, to have any kind of regulated sleep.
What do you mean by sleep clock?
Well, this is, I didn't know what it was, but let me explain the symptom, then you'll understand what the issue is.
Okay.
I couldn't fall asleep, and then when I fell asleep, I could not wake up. And since I lived such a high-performance, high-functioning life, that was devastating. And so you would have the cart put before the horse. Well, you can't sleep because you have these psychological issues. So let's figure out the issues and the behavior, and then you can sleep. So I spent decades doing that. It didn't work. Until I had a primary in the 90s, a primary physician who read an article about maybe disrupted sleep clock. And so she gave me 25 milligrams of amitriptyline beginning in the late 90s. And within 2 years, I was sleeping normally for the first time by 2001. I don't even take the med anymore. I can go to sleep whenever I want. I can wake up wherever I want. This did not happen until the sleep clock was identified. And yes, I dealt with issues of depression because I couldn't do the work I wanted to do. Mm.
And does the depression come from the lack of sleep, or does the lack of sleep come from the depression?
Right.
But what about this idea of a sleep clock? Are you familiar with that concept?
Yes. So what I think the caller is referring to are circadian rhythms. So that's that 24-hour kind of clock that's built into our body that tells us when to go to sleep and when to wake up. Now, what a lot of people have is what it sounds like she might have had was a delayed sleep phase issue, meaning that people with that problem can get a full night's sleep, but it's not on the timing that you would ideally like. So if you want to go to bed at 11 o'clock, this person or someone else might not be able to actually fall asleep until 4 or 5 in the morning and then sleep until 1. But as we know, many people need to be up much earlier than that to start their day. So there are different treatments. They're somewhat different from insomnia that can be used to reset sleep clocks or your circadian rhythm for these problems. And they can be very effective.
Deborah, thank you and good luck. It's our family meeting on sleep, the night shift, and your sleep coming up in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And maybe your NCAA basketball bracket got busted over the weekend, but luckily, WNYC's one and only bracket lives on. Perhaps you're familiar with the Bodega Cat Bracket Project. We've been asking you to submit your pictures as we try to find New York City's best kitty that lives in a corner store. Now it's time for the next round, and here to talk about the project, and believe it or not, some actual reporting he's done about Bodega Cats, is Brian Lehrer Show producer Jody Avergon. Hi, Jody.
Hey, Brian.
Do you have any sense of how many Bodega Cats there are in New York City?
It's a tough question. For some reason, are you a Bodega Cat, yes or no, did not end up on the last census in New York City. So, you know, we had the sort of estimate. I think there are about 11,000 bodegas in New York. That's also a really tough number to find. But
does that include 7-Elevens?
It's unclear. This is actually a really contested number. But the closest I found was, 11,000 or so. And there's no way to know how many Bodega Cats there are in those bodegas, but we've spoken to a lot of people. Most of the people we've talked to through this project know of at least one Bodega Cat near them. So I'd say they're very familiar to New Yorkers. I mean, I would rank them on the ecosystem of animals in New York below subway rats, but, above those whales that wander into the Gowanus Canal.
More than the whales, fewer than the rats. To be sure, did you see that article in the Times over the weekend about people on the Upper West Side not being able to start their cars because rats are getting into the engines?
I don't know if there are more of those or more Bodega Cats, but maybe we need trunk cats. Maybe that's our next project.
To balance out the under-the-hood rats.
Right, exactly.
All right, listeners, anyone out there want to add to the Bodega Cat discussion? Maybe you're a bodega owner and want to talk about why you have a cat in your store, or perhaps you're a customer who wants to talk up your local Bodega Cat or talk it down. Any vets listening? Later we'll talk about a vet who reached out to us with his concerns about the health of bodega cats. But the phones are open, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And a note to bodega owners, since there are some legal issues here, you can call anonymously if you would like. We're not trying to out any specific owner with this project. But owners, customers, neighbors, dogs, mice, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And here's the pretty basic question, Jody. Are bodega cats illegal?
I'm surprised you're not familiar with Article 81, Section 25 of the New York City Health Code, Brian. But yes, they are.
I only got up to Section 18 in my bedtime reading last night.
But yes, it says no live animal shall be kept, housed, or permitted to enter into or remain in any food service establishment. This section shall not apply to edible fish, crustacea, mollusks, or fish in aquariums. So unless you're planning on disguising your bodega cat as a lobster or something, you are risking the fact that, yes, bodega cats are illegal.
And do you know what the fine for having an animal in a bodega is?
Yeah, we reached out to the Department of Health to get some information about this. And the fine structure is actually changing a little bit right now, but the range is about $200 to $350 for each time a violation is cited. There's a little bit of a range there depending, I guess, as they put it, on the extent of the violation.
So $250, $300 for having a cat in your bodega. I'm curious how that compares to the fine for having a rat. Or
right.
A mouse.
So funny you should ask. It's just about the same. So there's this sort of weird symmetry there. And I think that's a calculus that a lot of bodega owners are making. There was a piece in the Times a few years ago about bodega owners, and some of them were quoted. And some of the ones I spoke to sort of said the same thing. The fine for vermin, rodents, is about the same as the fine for a cat. And if the cat is your most effective method for deterring mice and rats, then maybe it's worth it. And we just don't, you know, we just don't know how many fines are given out for cats in bodegas. It's just a hard thing to find.
I mean, is this something that the city cares to enforce at all?
Right. So again, we asked this of the Department of Health, and they didn't provide us with any firm numbers, but they did confirm what I suspected, which is that there are more rodent violations than live animal violations. I get the feeling that there are not that many live animal violations. And the owners that I spoke to said that they've never gotten a fine for this. When inspectors come, they're not actively asking about cats. But again, you know, this is a lot of this is sort of anecdotal.
And not that many fines given for having beached whales in your stores, no doubt. Paul in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
I sure can. Do I understand you're a health inspector?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
And while I do see a lot of cats out there, I'm not too. And while the law does indicate that there are no animals in the store, the cat also prevents the excessive application of toxins and poisons, which usually store owners that don't have a cat will depend on the exterminators. Which is a very hard job. You know, most at any store is going to get mice. From my experience, doesn't matter how well they put it together, there's always something, unless they're very, very, they make sure they cover every hole and every possible entrance.
So you see the bodega cats as a relatively clean alternative for keeping the rodent population down. Do you think, as a health inspector, that the bodega cats present any health risks themselves?
Well, supposedly, you know, people are dander is an allergen, and so it would affect people who are allergic to cats, and that's, I think, the main argument. That there are people with allergic reactions to cats. Of course, cats, they have their mind of their own. So when there's nobody in the store, what are they doing? Is another question as to, you know, the equipment, the food processing equipment, and the food in some cases.
Yeah.
But, if they learned how to control that, it probably would help, you know.
Jody?
Well, I'm just curious if you've ever actually given any fines or know of any of your colleagues who have.
Well, we don't determine fines, the inspectors, but I have heard from people that they have received a fine for when I put the cat down.
But you would determine whether someone receives a violation, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And do you give them four bodega cats, just the presence of bodega cats?
I do. When I write it down when they have feces boxes, cat boxes, that are full of feces, which is an attractant to flies.
So that's your standard.
Yeah, if they're very sloppy about their cat or they... You know, the cat is found interacting with the food, which I've had that happen, you know, where I found a cat eating the meat in a display or,
gross.
Yeah, or, you know, doing something else like that. Yeah, they're going to be cited for that.
Paul, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. So, Jody Evergan, what about bodega cats themselves? Did you talk to owners about where they get the cats, what kind of life they lead, whether they control for their cat's desire to go eat the meat and things like that?
I will say a lot of bodegas keep their litter box in the basement, and the cats sort of live this downstairs, upstairs life, and sometimes they even wander outside. But, yeah, I spoke to a number of owners, and I actually have a clip of someone who works in a bodega. This guy's name is Murat. He works in his family's bodega in my neighborhood. And here he is describing their cat, Jesse. And I threw in a little audio of Jesse purring at the end of this clip, too.
You want to know about her color?
Yeah, tell
me. She got yellow and white. Like, not yellow, it's gold, almost like that. Like, she got spots, a circle, and her body. The rest is white.
So that's me petting Jessie, and she's not the most vocal, but she's very cute. She purrs, and she's been there a couple years in this bodega. She came off the street, but she's pretty independent. They have, you know, food in the basement, but she goes out onto the street, hangs around. In the pictures we've been getting, we notice that bodega cats have a wide range of activity. Some of them hang out on the ATM. Some of them hang out on the sack of rice. The New York Post stand seems to be a particularly attractive place for bodegas to sleep. So they're very diverse.
And I think Jesse likes you. Is there any way of knowing whether bodega cats are healthy?
Right. So this is the big question. We started out this project because we wanted to see cute pictures of bodega cats. And about 2 days in, I got a call from Ted Wiener, and he's a vet at the Gotham Animal Clinic. And he was not actually very thrilled with our project. So I called him back and I asked him what his concerns were. And let's take a listen to his response.
Things that are concerned. One is that the cats that are being brought in are shown to be adorable and cute, but no one sees that cat stuck in the basement or the cat that hasn't been cared for or fed the appropriate way, not being neutered, food, environmental condition. I mean, these cats, no one knows whatever happens to these cats.
So, you know, that's one vet's take. He heard about our project, gave us a call. He's been a vet for 35 years, and he's said he's never seen a bodega owner bring a cat into his practice. And granted that, you know, that's just one vet, but I think it's a reminder that our project to gather these pictures is an inherently skewed sample, right? What cat are you going to take a picture of? It's the one that's friendly, that's healthy, that you have a good relationship with. So
is there
a
conflict of interest even, or a paradox that if bodega cats are healthy and well-fed, then they're not going to be going after the mice?
Right. So a lot of people have asked this over the course of this project, which is, you know, if you have a happy bodega cat, what's their incentive to be looking for mice? And the Department of Health actually, in their statement to us, said that, you know, they said, we haven't done any surveys, but most cats found in food establishments are too well fed to be effective mousers, which I didn't realize was a word. But
mousers. I think it might be with soft S, Mousers.
Mousers, really?
I think they may say Mousers. I'm not sure. But this is one for follow-up on our website. Anybody wants to pronounce Mouseers for us with the S or the Z sound, go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show, even though we could just look it up. But I've also thought, and maybe this is just a misconception that I have, that even cats who aren't hungry will go after mice just for the sport, the kill.
That's right. And the owners that I talked to said that. You know, they said, even though this cat is well-fed, we still have found it an effective deterrent. And I think our caller earlier was getting to a little bit of that, which is, you know, your bodega isn't a closed ecosystem. There's mice that can move in from other buildings. So as much, pest controls you do within your walls, sometimes having a mouse, a rat, a a cat patrolling that that perimeter is a really good method. And I did ask Ted, our vet, about this, and he had a response, which was not he wasn't buying it.
I mean, the question is, just because a cat might be able to deter a mouse from entering a food establishment, I am sure there are other ways of doing it as well. This is the year 2014. There's lots of traps for mice. There's lots of way of getting rid of mice other than having a cat.
Let's hear from some customers of bodegas with bodega cats. I think they're all over the map here. John in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, John. What's your experience?
Hi, Leonard. Well, actually, mine is not...
I'll say hi to Leonard for you, but go ahead.
Oh, mine is not the in Manhattan. Yeah, mine's not the cat that you see, but the cat that you smell. In fact, I live in Chelsea, and there's one particular bodega that I generally avoid, except on occasion when it's the only one open, because you walk in there, and the smell of cat urine is overpowering. And I've noticed that at a bunch of bodega cats. I think the main thing is usually it's a male cat that's spraying, but it is... It just smells like, I can't understand that they can even keep the place open, but I guess some people don't identify it as cat urine.
John, thank you very much. You would think it was bad for business, and the owner would have the self-interest to do something about that. Kenny in Bed-Stuy are on WNYC. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing, Brian?
Good. You have a local cat in your local bodega?
Yeah. You know, basically, I just thought, I'm allergic to cats, by the way, and, you know, if I had to choose between mice, rats, and cats, I'm going to choose a cat. You know, and just from my experience living in a brownstone, I have neighbors above, neighbors below who had cats. So guess where the mice ran to? My apartment.
Oh.
So you have to get
a cat.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm allergic, though, so I can't, you know. But
I'm allergic, too.
I like to see the bodega cats. It makes sense. And despite what your... guest said it's very, very hard to get rid of mice without the alternative methods. So they're so smart. They figure things out, how to avoid traps. They jump right over those blue traps.
So another argument for the cats.
They're very smart.
Kenny, thank you very much. I'm allergic to cats, dude. The one time I tried to have it, I got a cute little six-week-old kitten. I thought it was going to be the easy. My eyes swelled up. I had to get rid of it in a week. Bob on Staten Island, bodega cat story?
It's not necessarily a bodega cat story. It's not allergies. It's asthma. My daughter is severely asthmatic, as to the point when she goes to school, she has to put her coat into a separate cubicle away from all the other children's coats. She cannot visit anybody's house who has an animal. She will have an asthma attack the night if she's in a room where a cat or a dog or any sort of animal has been in.
So can you take her into any stores?
Well, they're not supposed to be in stores. That's the point. So when I walk in, I don't have bodegas in my neighborhood, but if I go into a Pathmark and you see, you know, the animals in the shopping cart or just to point out, when my daughter was unable to talk, she was 2 years old, she would have asthma attacks all the time until we found out that it was the animals causing it.
So do you want enforcement of bodega cat laws for the sake of asthmatic children?
I guess I would, but it could be very scary, especially if there's a child who can't speak and will have an asthma attack at night.
Bob, thank you. Mike in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mike.
Hi, I'm outreach for the Feral Cat Initiative, the Mayor's Alliance for Animals, and we find that with no law, well, actually the law against having cats in the establishment, the approach of the Department of Health inspectors is as varied as the care for each individual bodega. We've helped people to vaccinate and spay and neuter their cats in the bodegas. We go in and offer to do it because often unwanted litters of cats end up being put down at animal control. But the point I wanted to make is that if they did control it, you know, they would have a source of revenues. We could say that your cat in your bodega has to come from an animal control center. It will be neutered and vaccinated for rabies. And then you have to maintain a clean area separate from the food. And they could be fined on that basis. And there would be a source of revenue. And there wouldn't be this catch-22 where the owner is fined both for having a cat and for having rat feces or a problem. We get a lot of calls, not that the cat not they get fined for the cat, but they're told to get rid of the cat.
So,
and we get calls saying, please help us place this cat. We don't want to put it down, but the health inspector has told us we have to get rid of it.
So with your fundamental concern being the health and welfare of the cats, in the grand scheme of things, would you say these cats are generally better off than the majority of cats? I mean, of feral cats, they at least have an owner and they're at least fed, right?
There are some wonderful instances. However, I did go down into the basement of one. I saw a cat chained up in a filthy washroom because they were so afraid that the health inspector would come by that they chained the cat up all day long, and then they just let it out on the overnight hours when no one was in the store. And as soon as they came in, I must confess, I jerked the chain, I put that cat under my coat, and I walked out with it. Mm-hmm. But my fear is they went out and just got another one.
Mike, thank you very much for chiming in. And WNYC, Brian Lehrer Show producer Jody Avergan, who did this bodega cat reporting for us. Our fun March Madness bracket story, and we still have the bodega cat photo brackets going, turned into this pretty serious concern that people have that you kind of discovered.
Right. And, you know, this is public radio. We are we're comfortable living in the shades of gray around comfortable issues, around complicated issues. So, you know, I think I do look at these pictures a little differently now, but that doesn't mean that the cats aren't still super cute. And I do remain convinced that in the grand scheme of things, these cats have a better life than a lot of the cats you see on the street. I mean, I walk to my bodega, I see four stray cats, and then I get to the bodega and I see Jesse, who is, you know, compared to them, has a house.
So they're down to the final four in the actual college basketball tournament. What's the next step? How can people vote in our bodega cat brackets?
Right. So here's where we stand. We've taken all the pictures that were submitted and built this really great voting tool. Basically, you go to our site and you're shown a picture of a bodega cat and maybe a little description if someone submitted it. And you swipe left to vote a cat down and swipe right to vote a cat up. It's very visual. It works great on mobile. And it's kind of like the Tinder for cats.
Jody Avergan, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC.
Some say love, it is a river that drowns the tender reed.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Bette Midler is with us now, recalling her blue sky world of before the AIDS epidemic. She has just released her 30-plus-year-old book about her first world tour called A View from Abroad. Let's look back and look forward and look across to the Palisades now for a current piece of her activism with the divine Miss M. Bette, such an honor. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much.
You set the scene in the new introduction to the book saying by 1980, the 60s were finally over. The cloud of HIV/AIDS was about to descend on the blue sky world I was living in. Looking back, how would you describe that blue sky world of 1980?
Well, it was a frivolous time, you know. It seemed like it was a very creative time. There were a lot of wonderful things happening in art, in culture, in pop culture, in the huge amount of nightlife. It was just kind of reckless, a lot of reckless behavior. There was nothing dark on the horizon. That's what it felt like at the time.
And you were an icon for gay men in the 1970s. What do you think it was about your act that drew that crowd?
Well, you know what? I've been thinking about this, and I think I have a clue. First of all, the fact that what I did was so over the top.
Yeah.
It was it was extreme, but it was also everything. It had everything in it. It had music, it had chatter, it had jokes. You would laugh, you would cry. You know, it had a great deal of emotionalism. It was hyper, hyper emotional. So I think that's what drew them to me, and also the fact that I was that my name got around because I was working at the Continental Baths at the time. But I also think that when I stepped out into the wide world and was playing in nightclubs and small arenas and theaters, I think the fact that that entire community came together, and I don't think they had ever seen all of themselves in a room together. I think that really sort of knocked them out. I think they didn't realize there were that many of them.
It was before, it was after Stonewall, but it was before the contemporary height of the movement, which in a way formed around a response to the AIDS epidemic.
Well, yes and no. There was a lot going on between the Stonewall riots and the AIDS crisis. There was a lot going on. It wasn't as riotous as the AIDS crisis finally became, but there was a huge amount going on. There
absolutely.
Were lots of parades, lots of meetings, I remember being invited to, I could have gone, you know, all day, every day to this committee or that.
Uh-huh.
I went occasionally. I didn't go all that much because I was on another path, but it was curious to watch. The reason I say this is because I was interviewed the other day by a woman in Texas who said I was a when I went to your concert in the 70s, this is like the early 70s, I was a straight woman married straight woman, and she said, and when I got to your concert there were so many gay people, and I didn't know there were that many gay people in the world. I thought I was the only one. And I said, really?
You broke.
She said she came out 3 years later, and she blamed it on me.
You broke up that marriage.
I was so, I was like, oh, my gosh. I didn't know what to say.
You mentioned
I'm sorry. So the idea of that there was a community that they didn't know existed was, I think, something that had never occurred to me. I just heard about it last week. So.
And you mentioned the continental baths. For young people today who didn't come of age around that, I think it's almost inconceivable today. What feelings or images remain with you about that?
Well, but not what anyone thought about it. It was actually pretty wholesome, to tell you the truth. I wasn't interested really in what was going on behind the closed doors. I was really interested in getting up on the stage and honing my craft, which is what I did. And I had very long hair at the time, and my clothes were very, very low cut, and I was, you know, I wasn't wearing a brassiere, and I was wearing a lot of makeup, and, you know, really, camping it up, and my sense of it was a lot of fun. It was a very exciting for me because people really appreciated what I did. So for me, it was a completely different experience. I was at the center of it, and I don't think it will ever be duplicated.
Bette Midler with us on WNYC, talking about the re-release of her book from the early 80s about her first world tour called A View from Abroad. And we can take some phone calls for Bette Midler about then or now or tomorrow. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Or post a question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. Bette, you recall in the book that your goal was to make the book funny. But a lot of bad things as well as good things happened on the tour. Fist fights, drugs, accidents, arrests, screaming matches, fires, all your words. How did that tour make your 35-year-old self grow up?
Well, I realize, you know, the expression herding cats was probably created on that tour. How did it make my 35-year-old self feel? Well, I really wanted to get out from under. That was the first, you know, save yourself was probably my first instinct. But it was also pretty fascinating because it was there was so much acting out, and there was really very little you could do about it. I tended to, you know, to retreat, and I don't think that was really the healthiest thing to do. I, you know, subsequent tours, you would learn to sort of have meetings and kind of get a lot of things out in the open. In those days, we didn't do that. You know, people went their separate ways and were not what they were.
Today, you'd fire people.
Yeah, you would fire. You would fire. No, you don't fire. You discuss.
Uh-huh.
You know, you sort of discuss the whole group. You'll have like group therapy together, or you'll have a very strong road manager who's the enforcer. You'll have the enforcer.
And
in those days, you know, that kind of traveling for us was brand new. So we didn't really, you know, we were flying by the seat of our pants. It was it's a different world now.
One funny moment in the book is when you write, my choreographer had, since I last worked with her, turned in her tutus and gotten into punk. This time out, number after number emerged dripping with violence and hostility. Is that a true story?
That's totally true. Tony Basil, the crazy great Tony Basil. Oh, Mickey, you're so fine, who is still one of my best friends.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, she had decided she was into punk. Her picture is in the photo. Her photo is in the book. And one of the great moments of my life with Tony was when we made a movie together. Right after that tour, we made Divine Madness together, and she didn't think the costumes were punk enough, and she took a scissors to them just right before we were going to go on. So when the girls came to put their clothes on, they had nothing left. They were wearing, you know, two snaps and a set of buttons. It was hilarious, and of course the actual costumer was beside himself with rage. I mean, huh. I have to tell you, show business is a laugh a minute. It's also a tear a minute, you know. It can be heartbreaking and heartwarming and hilarious all at the same time.
But the punk scene with all that hostility and your gay bath scene dripping with all that love and lust were going on at the exact same time in Lower Manhattan, one more in the East Village, the other more in the West Village. Looking back, did something connect the two as 1970s expressions, or were they just both there?
I think it was all in the air. It was all in the air, and people just couldn't help but pick up on it. And don't forget, there was a lot going on in the drug world, and there was disco, which had taken over from, you know, sort of earnest music, earnest rock and roll,
right,
and earnest, very, very masculine rock and roll. And I think there was a major backlash at the end. In the 80s, I think everyone says disco is dead, January 1st, 1980, and that was the end of that. And the AIDS crisis started just around the same time. So there was a lot of bad behavior in the 70s, you know, huge amounts of drug ingestion and all that stuff, and bad, you know, hopping in and out of beds. And I guess the chickens came home to roost in a way. And that, you know, in a way they came home to roost in the 80s. So I think it was in the ether. It was the end of that generation's set of rebellions. And I was a kind of a bystander and a chronicler in a way. You know, I was a reflection. I wasn't at the heart of it. I was just reflecting it.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. Brian Lehrer on New York and New Jersey Public Radio with Bette Midler on the occasion of the re-release of her early 80s book, A View from Abroad, about her first world tour. Lisa on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC with Bette Midler. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was calling because in the late 70s, early 80s, my husband, who's since died, was diagnosed with AIDS, and I became HIV positive and been doing super well now. But in the late 70s, there were meetings that we went to where my husband was welcomed with open arms. Everybody was great, super sympathetic. He, you know, was really sick, and it was, you know, he got a warm welcome. And because I was a woman, and there weren't that many women, there weren't that many of us out there, and we definitely weren't going to meetings, there wasn't a huge welcome in, there wasn't a lot of support for us. And I often thought of Bette Midler, because Bette Midler, you have always been out there for everyone, not just gay men, but for HIV positive women in a kind of a cheerful, wonderful, great attitude way. And I always kind of thought to myself, well, if she can be out there and do it and be who she is, I can too. So you have served as an inspiration to me. And Lisa isn't my real name. I'm not using it because I have children who are grown. But I don't know. I just wanted to say how wonderful you are and how inspiring and how open and generous and non-judgmental. How wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you,
thank you so much. That's really kind. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lisa. We have a lot of calls like that we could take. Let's take at least one more. King in Glen Rock. You're on WNYC. Hello, King.
Hey, good morning. Thanks. I want to speak to in the time in the late 70s before technology, and that as a gay man in Louisiana, Bette Midler did reflect something that was extraordinary, and it wasn't just the art and culture. There was also an element of an outsider making it in a way that wasn't mainstream. I mean, Bette was diminutive. Jewish woman, seemed to have all this stuff against her, and she was bigger than life. And I remember seeing photos of her and having inspiration about myself without even understanding why. And so I respect her courage and what must have been a struggle, as all performers have, but seems to me probably more so for people who don't fit some stereotype of either talent or what we want to perceive as
King,
beauty.
King, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, King.
Does that ring true with you about the struggle? And
I, to tell you the truth, I was so lucky. I think that my will must have been, gigantic, because I just kept putting one foot in front of the other and not taking no for an answer. But actually what he says is correct. I was an outsider. I was different. I did look different. I sounded different. What I was doing was different. Although in the continuum, in the river of what performers do, I was really doing something that had been done, for eons and eons before me. I was I was the fool. I was telling jokes. I was a tumbler. I was making fun. I was sending things up. I was, and I was doing it all. I wasn't doing just one thing. I wasn't just singing or just dancing or just telling jokes. I was doing all of it at the same time. So, yes, I was an outsider. And there was a struggle, and the struggle continues, because you still say, well, didn't I get that part? And you realize, well, you just don't fit that. You don't fit that bill. You don't fit that role.
And he mentioned you being Jewish. You grew up as a Jew in Hawaii, didn't you?
Yes.
Where in Hawaii, and how small a minority?
Well, I grew up in a small town called Aiea, which is still there. And my parents moved to that town in the early 50s, like 51 or 52. And I went to second grade there. I started second grade there, and I didn't really go. It was an all Asian school. There were Hawaiian. Well, I shouldn't say all Asian. It was Polynesian, mostly Polynesians and Asians in the school. We were the only white family in the school for years. And then some white people came, and it was, oh, look, there's white people. But it was, my sisters were bullied. My older sister was bullied terribly. My middle sister, she did pretty well. She assimilated. But I was an introvert. I was a reader and a bookworm. I kind of stayed to myself. I was very shy.
And Jewish identified? Jewish
what?
Identified?
No, absolutely not. No such thing. Not on the radar. Jew, they didn't even know from that. What they did know is that you were white, and if you were white, you were like, it was anathema. They didn't want you near them. They wouldn't speak to you. I went from the time I was in second grade until the time I was in ninth grade with no one ever saying good morning to me or saying hello.
For being white.
Yeah.
In America.
No, in Hawaii, it wasn't really America. It was, to tell you the truth, it was a territory at the time.
Right.
And I,
Oh, right. It wasn't even a state. You were born in 1945?
I was. It was a territory.
So you were like the very first baby boomer.
I was. Don't tell.
Was your father in World War II?
My father came to Hawaii in 1933. He was in the army in 1933 in Waianae, on the other side of the island. And he came back to New Jersey, married my mother, and brought her over there in 1937, and then they stayed through the war. So no, he wasn't in the war. He worked for the Navy that whole time, and worked for the Navy until he retired. So
The time you were 20, you were on Broadway in Fiddler on the Roof.
I think I was maybe 24, 23, 24, yeah.
How did you develop your kinds of showbiz sensibilities in Polynesian Hawaii as a white minority of one?
I watched. I had my eyes open. I watched what was in the movies, and of course I daydreamed about that. We didn't go very often, but my mother only let me go to musicals because she was not a horror person or a sci-fi person. She only liked musicals, and she liked happy things. So it was all happy. We would go to the Esther Williams, or we would see Catherine Greyson or something like that, and it was an enchanting world. You know, it was three-stripe Technicolor, although I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know what to call it, but I knew the colors were as intense as they were if you went outside in Hawaii. It was gorgeous. So I fell in love with those sets and costumes and the attitudes and sounds, and I just sort of carried on from there. And when I was a little girl, I worked in the library with this with a girlfriend of mine. I was in the seventh grade, and the librarian sent me and my friend to a show on the other side of the island. My very first show, the first show I'd ever seen, the first real show I'd ever seen, and I think it was Carousel. And we were like in the seventh grade. We had to take a bus. Oh my God, we took a bus all the way. It must have been 20 miles, which was unheard of. And we got to the theater and we sat down and the curtain went up and I remember my heart beating really fast and the orchestra was playing, the little teeny-weeny orchestra was playing. And when the curtain went up, there were the most beautiful things, the most beautiful people I'd ever seen in my life. They were all pink and their hair was curly and they were wearing skimpy clothes and pink tights and high heels. And it was, it was just like a sight that, it was a vision. It was like something, it was like a way into heaven.
A pilgrimage to Carousel is what got you.
I never got over it.
Bette Midler with us for a few more minutes here on WNYC on the occasion of the re-release of her early 80s book,
A
View from Abroad.
Oh,
I want to talk about your appearance tonight at Barnes & Noble in a minute on Union Square, but one reason you are beloved by many New Yorkers is your work with parks and urban beautification and restoration.
Yeah.
How'd you first get into that?
Well, you know, I've always been heavily, very, very moved and very, very happy in the natural world. I love nature, in spite of what it did to me. I have a sense of order that I feel nature gives to you. I'm not saying this correctly. Let me backtrack and say I love nature and I love being in nature. And because I was brought up in probably the most beautiful spot in the whole world, the most benign spot in the whole world, we don't have any poisonous animals there, I've always felt very happy and very safe in nature. And when I came to the continental United States and I saw the carelessness with which people treated the natural environment, it really distressed me because it was a symptom of something that I couldn't really understand. That wasn't the way I had been brought up. You know, I was practically brought up in the Japanese way, which is to honor nature and that, you know, honor nature, honor your ancestors, and there's a spirit in every tree. So it made a big impression on me, and I really wanted to change it. And I know it was very, tilting at windmills to pick up a piece of garbage one piece at a time. But really, literally, that's what I set out to do. And I couldn't help myself. And I started doing it when I was very young, and it got more and more, it took hold of me in a bigger way when I came back to New York in 1995. The streets were so dirty, and the parks, some of the parks were really unlivable, uninhabitable. I mean, people literally couldn't go into them. So I started an organization called New York Restoration Project, and we started in upper northern Manhattan in Fort Tryon Park and Fort Washington Parks, and those are really, really beautiful parks, the jewels in our crown, and we've built parks. We built the Swindler Cove on the other side of the island up by Harlem River. We built the first boathouse in 100 years on the Harlem River. We have rowing programs going out of that, and it's been a thrill. Now we're in all five boroughs. We have community gardens. We bought our community gardens just at the time when urban agriculture was taking hold of the public imagination, and that has been a real thrill to see that happen. To see people say, "Well, gee, we really don't have any good food here. Let's have a farmer's market, or let's grow our own." It's been a thrill to watch, just a thrill.
I see you've spoken up and written a letter to LG in opposition to the height of their proposed office tower that would rise above the pristine cliffs of the Palisades across the Hudson from Fort Tryon Park.
Yes.
Can you talk about that issue?
Yes, I can. The Rockefeller family deeded the Cloisters Museum most and Fort Tryon Park, and bought the Palisades across from the cloisters, so that the view would be unspoiled. It was all a package, and it was a family package, and it was given to the city, to the state of New York, and to the city of New York, and to the state of New York, and the state of New Jersey. And it was kind of an unwritten agreement. The Palisades part was an unwritten agreement, and all the towns around the Palisades have, you know, have sort of held on to that code for, you know, since it was given in the, I think it was in the late 30s. And it's very, very beautiful. Now, LG, which is not an American company, it's a Korean electronics company, wants to build a gigantic tower sticking right up out of the Palisades Park, which will destroy that view and will probably encourage other corporations to do the same, so that the intent of the family will be destroyed. And I think it'll really ruin the impact of what that area had forever. And so it's distressing. It's really, really distressing. I know that change is inevitable, but certain kinds of change are not inevitable. And I think when people have what are considered national treasures or landmarks or historic landmarks or things that are really given to the entire public, not to just a conglomerate or to a corporation, they should cherish them, and they should take care. You know, they should cherish them, and they should see that generations to come are allowed to enjoy them the way we have, the way they were promised to us.
Nicely said.
I really do feel feel that it's incumbent upon us to save what belongs to future generations.
And you have at least four past New Jersey governors from both parties on your side. You know, Byrne, Florio, Kane, and Whitman have all weighed in against the LG eyesore plan. Do you have a minute for one more phone call?
Sure.
Dale in Jersey City, because I think he remembers the original release of this book. Dale? Dale, please be there. I think you have a good story for Bette Midler. Dale in Jersey City? Going once? Aw, all right.
Aww.
Well, I think he had a bookstore in Jersey City in 1980, and you did a book signing, and there was huge crowd. You remember that?
I went all over the country with my book. I sometimes say, you know, and I sold and signed every book myself. I really do believe that. Because I sold, we had these fabulous book signings where, you know, we would, you know, put balloon. We had a little set, and we would take questions, and we would sing a little, and it was a lot of fun. People lined up, and I signed all those books. It was fun.
Wait, here he is, Dale. Where was that book signing?
That was at B. Dalton Bookseller at 666 Fifth Avenue and 53rd, across from MoMA. And Miss Midler was terrific. She came in with this wonderful typewriter hat and delighted hundreds who stood in line around the block over to MoMA for hours signing the book.
There you go.
That was one of my finest hours. That typewriter hat was genius, I have to say.
And I see you're doing a book appearance at 7 o'clock tonight at the Union Square Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
And you told the Daily News you never buy a book online that you can buy in a bookstore. You think we're losing something culturally important?
No question about it. I am a big, big supporter of all bookstores everywhere. I go into them. They are my public spaces of choice. I love them. I sit around for hours. I dip into, you know, hundreds of books at a time, and I love them. I mean, I have my corner bookstore up here on Madison and 94th, which I, you know, I go to all the time. There's Crawford and Doyle. You know what? I'll tell you something. A town without bookstore is a town without culture. And you know what? Books themselves, print, the covers, the credits, the thank yous, the dedications, the all of it. I mean, I just love them so much. I do have my Kindle, but if I'm traveling, I'll put a book on a Kindle. But I won't just buy it to read it on a Kindle. I prefer to have the book, you know, on my belly in bed. I just prefer it.
Last question. How did you feel singing Wind Beneath My Wings at the Oscars for the In Memoriam segment? You know, you had Julia Roberts and half of America crying.
Oh.
Is it emotional for you as a performer, or do you have a different, just professional do this relationship to it?
Well, you know, that's very bright of you. Professional do this has to come first, because you can't crack. You know, you can't choke. it's imperative that you not choke. So you you do have to keep your emotions in check, and so so it's a delicate balance. I was very nervous before about the first week after I had been asked, and then I had to put all that nervousness aside and really concentrate on the what I had to do. So it was, you know, it was a struggle, and in the end I said, "Oh, I feel like I just won the Olympics. I think they cut me off. I didn't see it. I feel like I just won the Olympics," because it really was like training and getting ready for the big event, and then, you know, having it go very well and having the crowd like it. It was very, very gratifying, and I was really thrilled for the opportunity.
Bette Midler's book, A View from Abroad, from the early 80s, just re-released. Book signing tonight at 7 at Barnes & Noble Union Square. This has been so much fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian. Talk to you soon. Bye. Swears he's not to blame. Say to him, you know that broken, lonely woman. You tell you no, he don't even know my name.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.